evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, June 10, 2016. New York Times say the opinion piece published this week and co-authored by two South Sudanese leaders was handed to the newspaper by South Sudanese government officials. And South Sudan's government spokesman says more than 90 children abducted by Murule in April have been rescued.
So far, up to now, 92 children from those children who were abducted by the Murule from Ethiopia have been recovered and they have been returned to the Ethiopians.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. New York Times Communications Senior Vice President Ellen Mora says the opinion piece co-authored by President Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar was delivered to New York Times by Government of South Sudan officials. The New York Times article sparked reactions from both local and international rights groups condemning the government for changing the goalpost. The American newspaper posted a column said to be written by both President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar, which argues for an international government-led truth and reconciliation commission to investigate atrocities committed during South Sudan's two-and-a-half-year conflict. Jason Patinkin has more from Juba.
Kiir's spokesman, Eten Weketen, argues establishing a hybrid court would push the country back into violence.
The situation in South Sudan is very delicate. The people you would want to take to the court are still arms. And once they know that they are not protected, they are arms, they may cause havoc.
But justice is a key demand of many South Sudanese people who survived the war. Rights activist Edmund Yakan said the op-ed is an attempt for war criminals in government to avoid justice. He said if there is no justice, abuses will continue.
That confirms to me how they, as a politicians, are using violence as an option of buying power. Because if they could believe that use of violence is not an option of buying power, they could have really promoted justice so that in future, others will never use violence as a way of buying power. But I think because now they have the power, so they feel there's no need for justice.
Feelings for justice are particularly strong among Machar's supporters, who say they were targeted by Kiir's troops. Juba University political science professor Jacob Chol said if Machar is against the hybrid court, his followers would abandon him.
So if you say that, look, I want to leave justice, they will say, look, then you're not a serious man. They will look at him as a liar and bad politician.
Machar deputy spokesman Nyerji Roman accused Kiir's side of submitting the story without the vice president's approval. Kiir's spokesman Aten admits the president and Machar did not write the op-ed, saying it came from his office with help from international public relations experts. But he insists Machar approved the article. Roman said the former rebel side, called the SPLM in opposition, will cooperate with any court process.
If there is enough evidence that can link any one of SPLM-IO members to any crimes against us like humanity, then we'll hand them over to the court.
Professor Chol says the episode reveals problems of mistrust between Kiir and Machar, who joins in a unity government in April. Chol also says the fact the government stands by the op-ed shows they may fear an international court could succeed in prosecuting some of their members.
So there's a lot of worry from the government perspective that the court is going to take a lot of people in there.
For South Sudanese, the debate about justice for war crimes is far from over. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Juba.
An Ethiopian government official says 92 Ethiopian children who were kidnapped by South Sudanese gunmen on April 15 in the Gambela region of Ethiopia have been rescued. More than 200 people were killed and more than 1,000 heads of cattle were stolen on that day as well. Ayen Bior has the details from Washington.
Getachew Reda, Ethiopia's Minister of Communications, says the recent rescue mission is part of a long-term phased mission directed by Ethiopian troops who have crossed the border into South Sudan.
What we are doing is coordinating our efforts with officials the other side of the border, and our army has a strong presence there, and of course it's working closely with community elders, and they have been helping us retrieve the children on a phased basis. So now we have, the number was, about 5 days back, it was 88. Now we have 92 of them.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay confirms that dozens of Ethiopian children who were abducted and brought to South Sudan have since been recovered. McQuay briefed journalists today on security updates upon emerging from a cabinet meeting chaired by President Salva Kiir in Juba.
So far, up to now, 92 children from those children who were abducted by the Murle from Ethiopia have been recovered and they have been returned to the Ethiopians.
More than 130 children were reported to have been abducted by South Sudanese armed elements in April of this year. During the same attacks, more than 200 people were killed during cattle raids at the South Sudan-Ethiopia border. McQuay did not provide details as to how the children were recovered. Retta says armed Ethiopian forces are in South Sudan and will continue to look for and recover the remaining children. He refused to disclose the number of armed elements or where they are operating inside South Sudan. He also says the government of South Sudan is cooperating with the Ethiopians. For VOA News, I'm Ian Bior in Washington.
A majority of Sudanese refugees in Yusuf Batel Kam of in former Upper Nile State depend entirely on food distribution by aid agencies. But one refugee owns a small restaurant at the Gandaresa refugee camp in Mabon County, where she makes up to 200 South Sudanese pounds a day. Gift Friday has the story for VOA from Juba.
37-year-old Saura Tahir washes the dishes at her restaurant at the Gandaresa refugee camp in Mabon after serving dozens of customers. She wakes up early every morning to head to her restaurant and prepare for the breakfast and lunch day crowd. Tahir, whose husband remained back in Blue Nile State, says even though she lives in a refugee camp, she believes she must do all she can to make her children happy. Speaking in Arabic, Tahir says things slowly but steadily are getting better for her and her children as compared to when she first came to the Yusuf Batel camp 5 years ago.
My condition was bad, but now it has improved. In the last few months, there has been small income. At first, things were cheap, but now everything is expensive.
Tahir says she started by selling tea and kisra, a kind of thin bread made from flour. After she saved some money, Tahir bought bundles of grass and hired some men to build a hut with a grass-touched roof for her restaurant. She then bought some plates, saucepans and tea glasses to start her restaurant. Tahir says business has been good.
In a day, I used to get 100 South Sudanese pounds. That is how I started with the tea and kisra. But today, if I have the income, I get 200 South Sudanese pounds in a day. This money helps me in buying sauce and other important items for my children.
Tahir says she sells a plate of food for 15 South Sudanese pounds and a glass of tea for 5 South Sudanese pounds. With the money she earns, Tahir is able to send her children to school and buy their uniforms. She also uses some of the money to buy meat or fish for her children just to ensure they have a balanced diet. But Tahir says she worries because her husband and relatives are back in war-torn Blue Nile State. Asked to compare refugees' life with being back home in Sudan, she remembers about how things used to be.
There is difference between staying in a camp and back home in Blue Nile, where everything was available at home. You sleep happily because your husband gets to work and provide everything for the family. You only take care of the children. But now you have to first work and later get home to check on the children as they return from school and go back to work again.
But she says she's grateful to live a moderately comfortable life compared to other refugees in the camp. She says her small business helps keep her family going. Tahir says she often prays that peace returns to her country soon so that she can return home to live a happy life with her family and relatives. Gift Friday for VOA News, Juba.
A top United Nations official is warning that South Sudan could become a desert if people continue cutting down the country's trees at the current rate. Head of the UN Environmental Programme in South Sudan says the country ranks among the top 10 countries affected by deforestation. Mungume Devs Rwakarinj has this report for VOA from Juba.
Josette Azzi A single mother of three teenagers shielded herself from Juba's scorching sunshine and an umbrella shade in the Nyakron market where her Chako store is located. Taz says the Chako business used to be one of the most profitable businesses in Juba. She buys a sack of Chako wholesale at 280 pounds and sells it in the market for between 310 and 350 pounds. She also sells small packs at 10, 15 or 20 pounds. Speaking in Arabic, Tazi says she's aware that cutting trees affect the environment, but she can't afford to give up her business of 5 years.
This business helped me a lot because it helped me to take care of my children and it also helped me to pay for rent. I have been doing this business for about 5 years and it used to be very profitable, but now it is difficult. But even when you get something like 10 pounds, it can still be helpful.
And Tess says her job helps many people. The middlemen get 5 South Sudanese pounds of each sack and her customers have to pay for transportation of charcoal to their homes or restaurants. But the border driver, John Ochan, is one of them. He too is aware of the harmful effects of cutting down trees, but says with no other reliable source of fuel, charcoal or wood is the only alternative.
Yes, we prefer charcoal because with charcoal is easy, it is cheap, it is very cheap. You normally even able to access in the market. Yes, even in, you know, you go to the remote area, you find most people, they use charcoal or they use this one, what's called firewood. Yes, so we, as in the town here in the Juba, normally we prefer charcoal.
Ochan says he pays up to 50,000 pounds per day to buy charcoal for use for his 7-member family. Arshad Khan, who heads the United Nations Environmental Program in South Sudan, says an over-reliance on trees for fuel can have dire consequences for the country. Khan says many trees have been illegally cut for timber during the 2-year conflict.
There are some studies which were done, and it shows that you had teak and mahogany forest in part of central and western Equatoria at that time, which have been diminished almost, you know, and it's worth millions and millions of dollars in the international market. Plus, we don't have evidence, but there might be use the forest have been cut for, you know, personal gains and to support the armed conflict, you know, by selling the trees.
Forest cover 30-33% of the total land in South Sudan. Khan warns the continued cutting of trees for timber and charcoal could have dire ecosystem consequences for the country.
There is an estimate that the current rate at which the deforestation is taking place, it is between 1.2 to 1.5% per annum or per year. So if this trend is continued and there is no stoppage to this trend, there is a fear that within the next 50 to 60 years, there will be no forest left in South Sudan.
Lam Akol, South Sudan's new Minister for Agriculture and Food Security, says the only way to preserve forests is to ensure that all people are educated about the importance of preserving the forests.
This is a national project of national importance. It affects all our future. It affects the future of our generation. It affects our environment. It affects the climate, it affects our livelihood. Because if the ecosystem is disturbed, we may not have the rains to come, we may not have agriculture to cultivate, we may not have anything at all.
Speaking at yesterday's event to commemorate World Environmental Day, Nunu Jema Kumba, South Sudan's Minister for Wildlife and Tourism, said her ministry has adopted policies and laws that will help protect the environment. She did not elaborate. For VOA News, I am Mugume Debs Ruakarinj in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese women talk about democracy. Find out why when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today,
Do most people in your community have access to safe drinking water?
We have no access to safe water for drinking.
Okay, basically what we do, we buy this bottle on the water, but the pipe to one is not treated, so you can't take for domestic consumption.
Yes, they do. It's either borehole or from the tap. Those who don't have the taps, they buy from neighbors because they have boreholes.
Yes, they do. We have taps that flow into the homes, and we also have boreholes for those who also do not have the taps. There is good access to water.
People take their drinking water from different sources that may not be safe as water, as they are not well treated or they are not even treated, yeah.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Participants at a public forum in Juba on women's role in government agree that women must be steadfast in presenting their agenda and work hand in hand with men to address the challenges facing the country, including the need to restore peace. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from the capital, Juba.
Those are tens of women applauding a speaker during yesterday's public dialogue at the University of Juba main campus. The dialogue was aimed at gathering views to be included in a national strategy for enhancing women's participation in the transitional government of national unity. Pauline Riak, Deputy Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at the University of Juba, says both men and women can play similar roles in governance. She says, like men, women should speak out about issues affecting the country and be allowed to participate in making political decisions.
We are at a very crucial stage of our, a delicate stage of our unity, of our development, and we all need to be extremely humble, men and women, and to work with each other, to respect each other, to recognize that all of us, whoever we are, whatever age, all of us are citizens of this country and therefore entitled to equal treatment under the law.
Riak says South Sudanese men and women together should focus on restoring peace and stability in the country as a top priority.
I think each of us as individuals have an obligation to work in whatever ways we find possible, wherever we find ourselves, to work with each other, to work for the benefit of this country, instead of continuing to criticize and to complain and to carry it down. Because this is our country. We have no other country. And we are the ones who will make it or break it. But I'm confident, I'm very optimistic that we will make it.
Merikaje Lona, Secretary General of South Sudan Democratic Engagement Monitoring and Observation Program, says South Sudanese society does not value women as equal players or stakeholders in the democratization process. Lona says many people view women as being inferior to men, and that is why women are not allowed to participate in important decisions.
Take note of, like right now, the conversation about the selection of the speaker for transitional national legislative assembly. I think it's only normal for us to embrace the reality of life that women have what it takes, and it will only be normal for us to have a woman take up that position, because we are having the three arms of government. The executive is entirely led by men. The judiciary is entirely led by men. It will not be a mistake to see a woman heading the legislative arm of the government.
Rajab Mohandis, Executive Director of South Sudanese Network for Democracy and Elections, says women should have a clear agenda and a strategy on what they want to achieve.
We have seen women engaging in a lot of activities, but sometimes you don't see a clear outcome of some of these activities. We have seen women engaging in capacity building trainings, empowerment, and so on, and the list is endless. But if this is not done, the talking and discussions and meetings and workshops and dialogues will continue without tangible results at the end of it all.
Benny Gideon, a member of the South Sudan Law Society, agrees with the Mohandis and notes that South Sudan's legal instruments have remained the same despite new language in the constitution regarding women. He says Article 15 of the South Sudan Transitional Constitution empowers women to participate at all levels of government.
To the regional level, there is a Mobutu Protocol, which is known as the Protocol, the African Commission on Human and People Rights, specifically relating to the right of women to participate in political decision-making process, as well as the UN Security Council Resolution 1325. Not to forget the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, which South Sudan has also ratified in September 2014.
Gideon says the problem is not having appropriate laws, but rather the lack of enforcement of laws already in the Constitution. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudo in Juba.
The International Olympic Committee has announced a refugee Olympic team, the first of its kind in the 120 years of Olympic history. The refugee team is expected to compete in the Summer Olympics in August. The coaches and organizers of the team in Kenya say the creation of the team is more than a symbolic gesture and that the athletes are determined to compete to win the top prizes. Ian Bior has more from Washington.
Teams who compete in the Olympics are traditionally designated by country, and each country sends their best athletes to compete on the world stage. The International Olympic Committee, or IOC, has changed things up this year with their announcement that there will be one team at the Summer Olympics in Brazil's Rio de Janeiro, made up of refugee athletes from four different countries, including South Sudan. The other three countries that add to the plight of millions of refugees worldwide are Syria, Ethiopia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Duke Mwancha, a spokesperson in Kenya for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and a member of the selection committee for the refugee team, says the team wants to remind the world that refugees are regular people who want to live in a world where every individual can work to reach their dreams.
These refugees are going there to compete for the gold, just like any other athlete will be going there to do so. So it's not a symbolic thing. The only difference is that, you know, they're not going to represent any nationalities. They will obviously not have any national anthem of any country played, but they will be going under the umbrella of the International Olympics Committee. The Olympics anthem will be played, and they will be carrying around with them the International Olympics Committee flag.
All athletes left their home countries because of conflict or natural disasters and are now seeking refuge in their host countries, where they also go through rigorous training to prepare for the Olympics. Half of the team is made up of South Sudanese refugees who live and train in Ngong, a city southwest of Nairobi in Kenya. Mwancha says it is a coincidence that half the team is made up of South Sudanese refugees. Over 30 refugee athletes in Kenya competed for a slot on the refugee team, and the five from South Sudan had the best times. Mwancha says he is hopeful that the South Sudanese will bring much-needed awareness to the plight of hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese refugees.
Kenya and Ethiopia host the biggest number of refugees in Africa. And right now, the biggest crisis that we have is from South Sudan. So it's, for me, I can say it's something good that it can help to remind the world about South Sudan. It can help to remind the world about the challenges that this part of the world is facing right now.
The team members are training in their host countries, but will come together in August for the start of the Summer Games. Tegla Larub, who runs the Peace Foundation training camp, which has trained the five South Sudanese in Ngong, says the team is ready to compete in the Olympics, but they are understandably nervous.
You must understand, these are people who used not to run. They were just ordinary people. They came here, they trained for the last 8 months. So you can see the anxiety they have. Because going to Rio is something they didn't expect it will happen.
In an interview for the IOC media, South Sudanese 800-meter Olympic runner Rose Nathik Lakonyan says for her, competing in the Olympics will represent years of struggle for her and many other refugees.
Well, I'll be very happy to hold that flag of refugee because this is where I started my life and also like better some other people and maybe make them also to come together as you be one team, as long as even if we are from different nationalities, that one can bring us together and interact with so many people all over the world, the different countries. Maybe my first priority may be I need to help my parents also and my siblings. Then after that, I help also some of my fellow refugees as well.
UNHCR says it is seeing staggering numbers of refugees as displaced people worldwide hits an all-time high. The refugee agency says one in every 122 human beings are now either a refugee, internally displaced, or seeking asylum.
It could not have come at a better time. I think it's important that, you know, we have refugees there participating like everybody else, just as a reminder that, you know what, we don't have to overlook refugees. We don't have to forget about them. They are also human beings. They also have needs. They also have things that they want to do. They have dreams, including athletics and sports.
The South Sudanese Olympic athletes are all runners who will compete in the 400-meter, 800-meter, and 1,500-meter events. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
And finally today, thousands of people line the streets of the hometown of the famous American Muslim ever to say goodbye to the boxing legend Muhammad Ali, who died 1 week ago at the age of 74. Ali's family and loved ones took their places in the motorcade behind the vehicle that was taking the body past sites that were important to him in the southern city of Louisville, Kentucky. We asked some South Sudanese how they will remember Muhammad Ali.
I'm Joan Marino from Juba, South Sudan. Well, Muhammad Ali, what I've known him for is he's a great fighter, and that is all I know about him. I'm not so much in boxing, but I remember my days at school where teachers would talk about Muhammad Ali and being a great fighter. And in case of any challenges, our students will tell us, be like Muhammad Ali, get his spirit. That is all I remember about him being a great fighter, and it's something that used to keep me inspired, that there is no challenge that is too hard to be defeated.
I'm Tony. That guy was a hero. He has inspired many because he fight for the rights in Africa and all the world. They know him as a famous man. He was a hero.
My name is Caroline. I remember Muhammad Ali. He was a boxer. Yeah. My dad used to tell me more about Muhammad Ali. He was a famous person. Yeah.
My name is Ochan Ochan. I'm a filmmaker in Juba, South Sudan. Before, for the 8 hours now, I was watching clips on Muhammad Ali. I think he promised some guy that I'm going to punch you on the right cheek, and he punched him. That's what I know. Yeah, he's a good guy. He's a great guy. Yeah, inspires a lot. You know, inspires you to have strength and determination. That's what I know. Yeah.
I'm called Flexi. The first time I heard about Muhammad Ali was 1987, when he visited Yoweri Museveni Kaguta in State House, that's in Entebbe, in Uganda. I started knowing about him that time, and he was known, of course, for his boxing. He can fight whoever will, you know. He's like the Mike Tyson of this era, Evander Holyfield of this era. But he's a great man. I know so many people whom I'm mentioning right now maybe even were inspired by him. So many people will talk about his daughter. Besides, he lost few fights. You know, he fought many times. He lost about only 5 of them. If you compare him with any other great boxer at the moment, even of all time, you will still rate him above any other great boxer that you have ever come across.
These are some residents of Juba describing how they remember Muhammad Ali as the American heavyweight champion and humanitarian is laid to rest. Ali will be buried in a private service at the Cave Hill Cemetery, which is on the National Register of Historic Places. That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley. I'm John Tanza in Washington. You have a great weekend.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.